Kintsugi Heroes acknowledges funding and was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Find out more at cbf.org.au.
Welcome to the Kintsugi Heroes podcast, where we share inspirational stories of everyday people going through different challenges and how they overcome them. Please be aware that the story you're about to hear may have moments of deeply felt emotions and personal experiences. If anything you hear has a triggering effect, please reach out to someone who can help keep you safe. If you love this conversation, we'd love you to like and share it with your friends so we can continue to share more inspiration and hope to as many people as possible. Now, listen up for our next hero story.
This week, Kerry Atherton hears the inspirational story of Narelle Gatti, a resilient mother and computer programmer who adapted to life after losing her sight at the age of 42. Narelle shares how her upbringing on a cattle farm equipped her with the perseverance needed to face challenges head-on, despite her disability. Emphasizing the motto, "If I don't mind, it don't matter," Narelle delves into the importance of self-acceptance, her strategies for overcoming daily obstacles, and the vital support from her family and community. Enjoy this one with Narelle Gatti.
Welcome to another episode of Kintsugi Heroes. I'm Kerry Atherton and I'm your host, and today's guest is Narelle Gatti. In 15 minutes, when Narelle was 42, her life changed forever when she lost her eyesight. Narelle, welcome to Kintsugi Heroes.
Thanks, Kerry. Thank you so much for having me. 15 minutes? Yeah, it probably was. Yeah. I don't remember the time. I just remember it happened so quickly.
I know. When you told me about that, I was just astonished at how quickly everything just changed for you. But before we talk about that day, could you take us back and share what life was like before that? Because I know that you were working in a role that where your eyesight was imperative for that role, and so much would have changed. But if you can take us back and just give us a snapshot of what life was like before that and then lead into what happened that day, then we'll hear the amazing things that you've been doing since to help raise awareness of the great need for communication and making things accessible for people that are struggling with disabilities.
Oh, thanks, Kerry. Yeah, look, I'm a typical mum. When all this went down, my dad had died about 18 months prior. I had my oldest son was in grade 8 or 9. I can't remember. My middle son would have been grade 7 or 8, and my youngest son would have been grade 4, grade 5. Obviously, they were at school, and I was working. My husband was working. We lived at a suburb of Brisbane where there wasn't much public transport, and that's important for what happened. And there was a train and there was buses about every half hour or so. We lived at the end of a cul-de-sac. We had quite a fair-sized block, and yeah, we were just enjoying life. So to go and see my mum, I would hop in the car about 4 o'clock in the morning with the boys, my lad. And we would drive about 8 hours to central Queensland, because where Mum lived at the time, there was no public transport at all. Mum was still driving at that stage. And to go and see my sister, it was 11 hours. And there is no public transport where my sister is either. My older brother, he lives at Rockhampton, so he wasn't as hard, but he was travelling out to where our cattle property is. I grew up in a cattle property. And my younger brother, he was at Rockhampton, outside Rockhampton as well. And, of course, most of my family are all out bush where there is no public transport.
Right. Wow. Yeah,
so we'd actually, we were living in a suburb north of Brisbane and having a lovely time. And I was working in Brisbane itself. I was working in the public service. I'm a computer programmer by trade. So I was writing code, cutting code, whatever you want to call it. And part of my work involved validation that required looking at MAP, the tool called Esri. And that is a mapping tool that you won't realize you're looking at, but you do see it all over the place. And it was validating. And that's the way I had to validate and test my code that the results we got were correct, because I could look at the maps and say, in essence, road A connects to road B. In essence, that's the very basic of what we were doing at the time. So, yeah, thought it was really important. And I started that job only about 3 months before, and I started having car accidents, which really threw me. And I thought, oh, something, you know, that car suddenly popped up. God, they were speeding, you know. It's what you assume. And then I started falling over chairs, and I'm thinking, oh, for God's sake, what's going on? And I just got a new set of glasses, and I went to my optometrist, who also happened to be one of my good friends. Basically said, Lisa, yeah, I think the glasses have got a problem. And she said, what do you mean? And I told her what happened. So she started doing, getting me to do a test called Feel. And it basically tests what you can see in the fact of, you know, where something is in space. It could be a tree over in the left corner or whatever it is. That's just an analogy. Basically, I had no feels. I could see directly ahead, which is why I was having car accidents and falling over chairs and everything else. I was actually legally blind to all intents and purposes. So I'd driven there. My Lisa's husband went to get my husband. And from that moment on, I was never allowed to drive again legally, which means, you know, kids' sports, groceries, you name it, doctors. Everything had to change. Even, you know, dropping the kids off and getting kids to and from school, everything that I was doing as a mum, as a wife, had to change because I couldn't do it. Still worked.
Yeah.
I still did the cooking because I still had direct sight, but it explained a lot of things. And it also changed my husband's life full on. It changed my kids' life full on, because suddenly they had to step up and be more, my kids had to be more responsible. My husband had to take over jobs that I did.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't drive the kids to footy practice or cricket practice or, you know, all of those things. I couldn't do any of it.
Wow.
There was no public transport. There was no, you know, it was impossible.
You must have gone through so many emotions at that time when you had that realization that life was changing dramatically.
It could, in a way, but because, don't forget, I have two autistic kids as well. They were all at school. Going home, it was, oh, my gosh, oh, my gosh, what am I going to do? Get home with, okay, get dinner, get the homework done, make sure the clothes are ready, you know, all the normal mum stuff.
Yeah.
And then afterwards I had to say to my husband, oh, I can't remember which sport it was. The practice is on tomorrow. How are we going to get them there?
Wow.
And then it was, whoops, say if it was football, well, hang on. We only had one car. Thank gosh we only had one car. And what we used to do was one of us would drive to the one game with the one kid, and we had two in one team and one in another. And that parent would stay with that child and the other would drive to wherever the other had to go. And now we couldn't even do that, and we had to do a lot of problem solving to try and fix the immediate problems very quickly, you know, just to get through the next day. After that, it was, what do we got to do the next day? Let's solve that one. And we just had to break it down. Being analysts probably helped.
Yeah.
But we didn't have, I didn't have the opportunity to grieve or anything, because we had three kids. I was still mum. He was still dad.
Mm.
And we had to get them to what they needed to do. And I remember I rang a friend of mine that I was very close to and told her, and she went, oh, okay. Because what do you say? And she was brilliant. And, you know, she was actually, at that time, we didn't realise that she was ill as well. And we just had to problem solve very quickly to get things through. It was hard. It was, looking back, I just don't know how we did it. We just did it. because we had no option.
Narelle, do you think growing up on a property, because you said you grew up on a cattle farm?
Yeah.
There's a lot of resilience in the background, isn't there, with farmers and their families. Do you think that that made an impact on how you were able to get through this hard time?
Yeah, I like what a friend once said, you're tough because your father was tough on you. But we didn't have electricity when I was growing up. I was 12, I think, when we got electricity. So I was used to a wood stove, kerosene lamp, generators. If we didn't have the generator on, we used the kerosene lamp. We had kerosene fridges, kerosene heaters. We didn't have a shop. You know, the nearest shop was only covering the basics. So if you needed food, it was an hour away. So we made do. You know, Mum grew the veggies. We had to ration water in the dry time. You know, we had cattle. But you learnt to make do because that's what we had. And making do was probably our saving grace because, you know, even with the groceries, we just suddenly made sure we always had milk powder in the cupboard. So if I didn't have milk, well, we had milk powder.
Yeah.
If they didn't eat it, they'd get over it.
Yeah.
We just had to do things like that. And we would shop. We always had like the spare packet of Weet-Bix, the spare whatever it was. Like we started buying meat. Well, I always bought meat in a bit of bulk, but we actually bought meat in bulk. We went and got a freezer because then we didn't have to worry about that so much. It was just easier. We bought bread in bulk. We bought milk in bulk. Everything we just did in bulk. And then because then the food was there. If Ma couldn't go shopping, it didn't matter. The food was there. We just had to change. And really it was going back to what I grew up with in doing that. But clothes were an issue because, you know, kids growing out of their clothes really quickly. Uniform shop at school, I couldn't get to the uniform shop.
I know.
I was reliant on friends. I would ring up this friend and she was actually running the uniform shop and I'd say, yeah, Pete's gone out of whatever, and she'd say, right. And she'd grab him and say, get in here, Peter. And he'd go, yes, Auntie Pauline. He used to call her his Auntie Pauline. And she'd sort it. And then she'd ring me and say, I've paid it, you owe me whatever. And that's how we had to do uniforms. Or, you know, it was everything. It wasn't just one thing because, you know, we had developmental pediatricians with our Asperger's boy. We had, you know, all the medical stuff that you have with kids. We had kids in braces. So the things we did to get around things, and back then there was no NDIS. There was no support for what I was going through. There wasn't any.
Yeah.
So you just made do and worked it out. Because you had no option.
How did your kids cope with the changes, Narelle? Did it really impact them? I mean, I know it would have definitely impacted them, but how did they cope with that?
We brought them up to be independent anyway. We were really set that they would know how to clean and cook and everything else. So by that stage, they knew how to cook and clean. And by that stage, we'd already said, you're old enough to make a sandwich on a weekend. You're old enough to make your own lunch. So they were making their own lunches anyway. It came down to the homework became an issue because Mark always got home a lot later than me. So I would catch the bus home, you know, catch a train, catch a bus, get home that way. And then I'd have to say to the boys, okay, I could still see in front of me, but they had to take on just a lot more responsibility. I was still doing the mowing. I still did most things. However, the more sight I lost, the more they had to pick things up and just run with it. So it became, it's sort of like a night blindness. I really struggled at night. So the boys had to, I would have the dinners cooked for the week. They would then have to cook veggies or cook some rice or cook some pasta, heat the meals up and set the table and those things. And they just had to do it. They wanted to eat, they had to do it. And they stepped in. And I'm so lucky. And my husband just he stepped in with the shopping and the footy training and the cricket and all of those things. He just had to do it, but it became too much. So the kids didn't get to do that in the end. They didn't ever work outside the home because with only one person with a license having to go and do the grocery shopping and do everything else, he couldn't then drive them to a job pick them up and all of those things, that had to stop, that they never had those opportunities. It's impacted them that way. In saying that, they learned a lot of other skills. They never thought anything of mum just can't be properly. Like even to go for the parent-teacher meetings, I used to have to take the day off from work and I used to catch the school bus with the kids. And that's how I got parent-teacher meetings. And the kids used to hate it. And so did the other kids because I knew a fair few of the parents. So I'd be hopping on the school bus with all these kids. I knew the parents. It is Mrs. Gaddy's on the bus. And I, because I knew the bus driver, you know, it wasn't the biggest suburb, so I knew the people. And the teacher would meet me at the school and off we'd go. But the kids just, they're resilient. The kids, we'd already taught them how to think outside the square, how to make do, how to be resilient. Mind you, that they worked out how to talk their way out of things at school at times, but that was their choice and their consequence, and they had to live with that. They knew what they had to do.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it's just what it was.
Narelle, despite the fact that you had to just get on and be resilient and keeping on and keep the wheels rolling,
yeah,
did you ever have really hard days? And if so, what did you used to tell yourself to help you get through? Because there's a lot of people that will be watching this that won't have lost their eyesight, but they'll be faced with something else that's really life-changing. And hearing from someone resilient like yourself will be really helpful for the person that's going through that.
It was really hard. It was really hard. It was, I had to keep telling myself that I'd taught my, especially my Asperger son, we'd always taught them there's more than one way to skin a cat. There's more than one way to do something. Just because I can't do it one way doesn't mean there's not another way to do it. So like sweeping a floor, I would start missing because I didn't realise that I was missing. So I'd have to think, okay, so we got a better vacuum cleaner. And then I would take a step, vacuum around that area, take a step. I had to relearn. And that's not just with that, it was with the cooking. I don't know how many times I've relearned how to do everything. But in the end, I had a saying that was, if I don't mind, it don't matter. And then I had to convince myself that I don't mind.
Oh, I love that.
It came down to me having to say, well, I've got to do it.
Yeah.
I am still a mum. I am very much a wife, and those two roles are very, very important to me. I am a daughter, and that role is very important to me. I am a sister.
Yeah.
And I am a friend, and they are an important role. So if I wanted to be there and have those people in my life, and don't get me wrong, I did cry. I did a lot of crying in the shower.
I can imagine you would have.
In the shower, not in front of the boys, because I used to say to the boys, get over it, get on with it. You've got to live.
Is for the private time.
Yeah, it was the private time. You know, or when they'd be at school, I'd ring my mum and say, oh, my gosh. And my sister and my closest friend Jude, I've got a sister Jude and my closest friend Jude, and they became my saviours. I would start to have panic attacks and I'd ring my sister and my sister would say, right, let's start breathing. And we'd breathe through it and I'd say, right, I can do it now. Or if I couldn't get my sister, I'd ring my friend Jude and she'd say, it's okay. Come on, stop it. Don't be stupid. Get on with it. And then came the day when my friend Jude rocked up to my place and said, sit down. And I said, yep. Had our cuppa and she said, I'm dying. I'm not going to be here in 6 months. And I said, what? And she told me, and she was dying.
Oh.
And she said, so losing your sight's nothing. You're taking on my girls as well now. And I said, yeah, they're my girls. And they are still my girls. And so all the six kids, they just accept disability. I've got one of the girls has a lot of disability.
Okay.
And she's been taught to get on with it as well.
Yeah.
But Jude, the two Judes got me through, my mum and my husband, because my husband would give me a hug and he'd say, it'll be right.
Oh.
Get over it. It'll be right. But it's better saying get over it, because there's two things you can do in life when you face something, an obstacle. You can turn it into a barrier, sit in the corner and cry.
Yeah.
or you can turn it into a challenge, stand up and say, okay, how am I going to fix this? How am I going to do it? I choose and laugh. You've got to laugh. Find the funny side in whatever it is. And I choose to make it a challenge. I choose to laugh. And it is a choice. I choose to get on with it.
I just love your attitude so much and your resolve and what you're doing today, really, to pave the way and make a difference and stand up and be a voice for all those people that are struggling with disabilities. But not only that, to raise awareness and educate people in the community about how they should treat people who have a disability and how they shouldn't treat people who have a disability. Talk to us a bit about that and also tell us about your podcast, The Digital Access Show.
How to treat people with disability? Treat them like everyone else. To be honest, their disability is no one else's business. Don't ask them. I'm often asked, I have a guide dog. And I'll say, are you training the dog? And I'll say, no, he is my guide dog. Oh, are you blind? Well, yes. There are degrees of blindness, but I just say yes. It's simpler. Ask, go up and say good day. Don't stare.
Yeah, that's
it. Don't say, hi, Narelle. In my case, hi, Narelle, it's Kerry. Or, so I know who I'm speaking to, because if you just go, hi, Narelle, I've got no idea who I'm speaking to. And I talk to so many people each week. With a person that's down, just say, good day, how you going?
Yeah. To say, hi,
yeah.
Kerry, because people who aren't vision impaired just take that for granted, that the person knows who I am and who they're talking to, but always the case.
And my biggest thing is don't assume anything. Never assume. A person could be just having a really bad day and may need time out, so they might just nod and keep walking. It's not rudeness. You don't know what's going on in their life. It might be they're deaf and can't hear you anyway.
Yeah.
It could be that they have their mind on something else completely and didn't notice you. It could be that they are incredibly shy.
Yeah.
Or they have anxiety. It could be so many reasons. But just say, if they come up to you or, you say, don't stare, just keep walking, because we are all normal. Everyone is normal. The person that has no hair is normal. The person that has a big nose is normal. Or a person that has incredible height is still a normal person with feelings. So, if you're in a room with them, just say, hi. I'm so-and-so. How are you going today? How's your week been? Normal conversation. If they choose to tell you, they'll tell you. If they don't choose to tell you, that's fine, because everyone's a person. And what I am doing, I've started a podcast called The Digital Access Show, and it's related to everything I do now, which is telling people about the Digital Accessibility Standard, which are a set of standards maintained by Standards Australia, and it tells us how to set up all the digital content so that everyone, regardless of ability, actually most people, regardless of ability, can access the information and understand it and read it. And it helps so many ways with just that mental lift that you're able to be yourself and be independent and not have to ask someone to read it or someone to ask you, what are they saying? Because I didn't hear that. These rules, these guidelines are there, and they're backed by the Human Rights Commission. They're backed by the Disability Discrimination Act 1992. So we decided to set up a podcast around all of that. And the theme is communication, usability, and accessibility in the digital world. So we talk to people about the way they do things. A couple of weeks ago, it was this fantastic bloke called Patrick Dillon. And Patrick is a disability employment specialist who also happens to be a quadriplegic, works full time.
Yeah.
And it's how the tools he uses. We talk to a guy called Mark Muscat, and he's never had sight. He is a digital accessibility trainer and travels Australia doing it. Alan Parker, who's dyslexic, and he's a microbehavioral neuroscientist and forensic linguist.
Yeah.
And he travels the world teaching mediation, negotiation, and working as a negotiation specialist and teaching communication. He loves neurolinguistic plasticity, big word there. So how the brain works. It's just awesome stuff. And like Paula Burgess, who runs a business, and she's also got an ASD son, and the way that they work with him, and Grace Cameron, who has a disability called postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, POT.
Right.
So she runs a business lying on a bed 23 hours a day, but she can't stand for too long. Or Adam Morris, no sight, and he works full time, and the tools that he uses and the challenges he has. Yeah, they're everywhere. Meryl Evans, who is she's deaf, she's hearing impaired, lives over in the US and does what I'm doing, but over in the US.
Wow.
We looked at differences between the US and Australia. So it's all about communication and how people communicate and the digital tools that are out there that assist everyone.
Really lets people know who are struggling with whatever it might be that they're not alone.
Yeah.
I think that's the thing that's so important, isn't it, when people are struggling to know that they're not alone.
They're not alone, Kerry. There are so many people out there that are really either embarrassed, and that's sad because they've got no need to be embarrassed.
Okay.
They are who they are, and it comes down to accepting yourself. That's the hardest issue. Or they feel that other people just don't get it. But, again, it's learning. That's the other person's issue that's not theirs. They go out, they be part of our society, be part of our community, because there are so many people in the world that do want them.
I love that, Narelle. And, look, just something that I was thinking when you were sharing about the different guests that you have, but also what's happening for our older generation this digital world. I know that so many of them are feeling absolutely hopeless because they can't understand the new ways that are of the way things are operating. And so is your podcast something that could really benefit the older generation who have to kind of learn all over again, who probably are struggling with, you know, minor hearing loss and different things like that?
Yeah, it could. I would say to those people, though, you know what? You've got the right to ask for the information in the way that you want it. It is your right. If they say email address, you say, don't have it. You need to send it to me on paper.
Right.
They have that right, and they should exert that right. There is no law that says you have to have an email address. If you don't want an email address, if you don't want a smartphone or feel that you can't use it, don't have it.
Yeah.
But, you know, things can still be done on paper because it is your preferred communication style. If the business wants your money, then that is your preference.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Yeah. Well, as we come to a close, it's been such a delight to interview you today. And there's so much more we could talk about. Maybe we'll have to do a take two another time. What message would you like to leave with all of our viewers today?
Never be ashamed of yourself. Never be ashamed of who you are, because you know what? You can do what you need to do. Treat it as a challenge. It's never a barrier. Sometimes you may have to ask for help, and I've asked for help tons of times, and I will do it again, because asking for help is nothing to be ashamed of. It's saying you need to learn something different. And for everyone that doesn't have a disability, we're all normal people. It's the bottom line.
Oh, well, thank you, Narelle. You're an absolute inspiration, and thank you to everyone watching today.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Kintsugi Heroes. please like and share the show to your friends so we can get this out to even more people. If you have a story you'd like to share with us, please reach out using the contact details below. And join us next week for our next Heroes story. Until then, keep being you and remember that we are all heroes in our own unique way.
Only when it's broken. Only when it's broken. When it hits you in the middle of the night and the truth burns so bright. Only when it's broken. Only when it's broken. Take pride in those cries. It's only for tonight and then you rise. Only when you're broken. Only when you're broken. Only when you're broken.